"There is no need for your employers to be angry." Malthus took a step forward. His forehead was glistening with sweat, though the room was not hot. "They are not angry, Superior. You could not have known that they would be displeased. Now you know. Were you to continue with this line of investigation, knowing that they are displeased, then they would be angry." He leaned down towards Glockter and almost whispered, "Please allow me to tell you, Superior, as one piece on the board to another. We do not want them angry." There was a strange note in his voice. "He does not threaten me, he pleads." "Are you implying," Glockter murmured, scarcely moving his lips, "that they would inform Archlector Thalt of their little gift to the defense of Dagothka? That is the very least of what they would do." Malthus's expression was unmistakable. Fear. Fear in that emotionless mask of a face. Something about it left a certain bitterness on Glockter's tongue, a certain coldness down his back, a certain tightness in his throat. It was a feeling he remembered from long ago. It was the closest he had come to being afraid himself in a long time. "They have me, utterly and completely. I knew it when I signed. That was the price, and I had no choice but to pay." Glockter swallowed. "You may tell your employers that there will be no further inquiries." Malthus closed his eyes for a moment and blew out with evident relief. "I am delighted to carry that message back to them. Good day." And he turned and left Glockter alone in Ardy's living room, staring at the door and wondering what had just happened. Chapter 49. The Abode of Stones. The prow of the boat crunched hard into the rocky beach, and stones groaned and scraped along the underside. Two of the oarsmen floundered out into the washing surf and dragged the boat a few steps further. Once it was firmly grounded, they hurried back in, as though the water caused intense pain. Giselle could not entirely blame them. The island at the edge of the world, the ultimate destination of their journey, the place called Shabulion, had indeed a most forbidding appearance. A vast mound of stark and barren rock, the cold waves clutching at its sharp promontories and clawing at its bare beaches. Above rose jagged cliffs and slopes of treacherous scree, piled steeply upwards into a menacing mountain, looming black against the dark sky. "Care to come ashore?" asked Byers of the sailors. The four oarsmen showed no sign of moving, and their captain slowly shook his head. "We have heard bad things of this island," he grunted in common, so heavily accented it was barely intelligible. "They say it is cursed. We will wait for you here." "We may be some time." "We will wait." Byers shrugged. "Wait, then." He stepped from the boat and waded through knee-high breakers. Slowly and somewhat reluctantly, the rest of the party followed him through the icy sea and up onto the beach. It was a bleak and blasted place, a place fit only for stones and cold water. Waves foamed greedily up the shore and sucked jealously back out through the shingle. A pitiless wind cut across this wasteland and straight through Giselle's wet trousers, whipping his hair in his eyes and chilling him to the marrow. It snatched away any trace of excitement he might have felt at reaching the end of their journey. It found chinks and holes in the boulders and made them sing and sigh and wail in a mournful choir. There was precious little vegetation, some colourless grass, ill with salt, some thorny bushes, more dead than alive. A few clumps of withered trees, higher up away from the sea, clung desperately to the unyielding stone, curved and bent over in the direction of the wind, as though they might be torn away at any moment. Giselle felt their pain.
"A charming spot!"
he shouted, his words flying off into the gale as soon as they left his lips.
"If you're an enthusiast for rocks!"
"Where does the wise man hide a stone?" Baez hurled back at him.
"Among a thousand stones, among a million!"
There certainly was no shortage of stones here. Boulders, rocks, pebbles, and gravel also were in abundant supply. It was the profound lack of anything else that rendered the place so singularly unpleasant. Giselle glanced back over his shoulder, feeling a sudden stab of panic at the notion of the four oarsmen shoving the boat back out to sea and leaving them marooned. But they were still where they had been, their skiff rocking gently near the beach. Beyond them, on the churning ocean, Corneille's ill-made tub of a ship sat at anchor, its sails lowered, its mast a black line against the troubled sky, moving slowly back and forward with the stirring of the uneasy waves.
"We need to find somewhere out of the wind," Logan bellowed. "Is there anywhere out of the wind in this bloody place?"
Giselle shouted back.
"There'll have to be. We need a fire."
Longfoot pointed up towards the cliffs.
"Perhaps up there we might find a cave or a sheltered spot. I will lead you."
They clambered up the beach, first sliding in the shingle, then hopping from teetering rock to rock. The edge of the world hardly seemed worth all the effort, as far as final destinations went. They could have found cold stone and cold water in plenty without ever leaving the north. Logan had a bad feeling about this barren place, but there was no point in saying so. He'd had a bad feeling for the last 10 years. Call on this spirit, find this seed, and then away, and quickly. What then, though? Back to the north? Back to Bethod and his sons, racks full of scores and rivers of bad blood? Logan winced. None of that held much appeal. Better to do it than to live in fear of it, his father would have said. But then his father said all kinds of things, and a lot of them weren't much use. He looked over at Pharaoh, and she looked back. She didn't frown, she didn't smile. He'd never been much at understanding women, of course, or anyone else, but Pharaoh was some new kind of riddle. She acted just as cold and angry by day as she ever had, but most nights now she still seemed to find her way under his blanket. He didn't understand it, and he didn't dare ask. The sad fact was, she was about the best thing he'd had in his life for a long time. He puffed his cheeks out and scratched his head. That didn't say much for his life, now he thought about it. They found a kind of cave at the base of the cliffs, more of a hollow, really, in the lee of two great boulders, where the wind didn't blast quite so strongly. Not much of a place for a conversation, but the island was a wasteland, and Logan saw little chance of finding a better. You have to be realistic, after all. Pharaoh took her sword to a stunted tree nearby, and soon they had enough sticks to make an effort at a flame. Logan hunched over and fumbled the tinderbox out with numb fingers. Drafts blew in around the rocks, and the wood was damp, but after much cursing and fumbling with the flint, he finally managed to light a fire fit for the purpose. They huddled in around it.
"Bring out the box," said Baez. And Logan hauled the heavy thing out from his pack and set it down next to Pharaoh with a grunt.
Baez felt around its edge with his fingertips, found some hidden catch, and the lid lifted silently. There were a set of metal coils underneath, pointing in from all sides to leave a space the size of Logan's fist.
"What are they for?" he asked.
"To keep what is inside still and well cushioned."
"It needs to be cushioned?"
Canadius thought so. That answer did not make Logan feel any better.
"Place it inside as soon as you are able," said the Magus, turning to Pharaoh. "We do not wish to be exposed to it for longer than we must. It is best that you all keep your distance."
And he ushered the others back with his palms. Luthar and Longfoot nearly scrambled over each other in their eagerness to get away, But Kwai's eyes were fixed on the preparations, and he scarcely moved. Logan sat cross-legged in front of the flickering fire, feeling the weight of worry in his stomach growing steadily heavier. He was starting to regret ever getting involved with this business, but it was a bit late now for second thoughts. "Something to offer them will help," he said, looking round, and found Baez already holding a metal flask out. Logan unscrewed the cap and took a sniff. The smell of strong spirits greeted his nostrils like a sorely missed lover. "You had this all the time?" Baez nodded. "For this very purpose." "Wish I'd known. I could have put it to good use more than once." "You can put it to good use now." "Not quite the same thing." Logan tipped the flask up and took a mouthful, resisted a powerful urge to swallow, puffed out his cheeks, and blew it out in a mist over the fire, sending up a gout of flame. "And now?" asked Baez.
"Now we wait. We wait until—"
"I am here, Nine Fingers."
A voice like the wind through the rocks, like the stones falling from the cliffs, like the sea draining through the gravel. The spirit loomed over them in their shallow cave among the stones, a moving pile of grey rock as tall as two men, casting no shadow. Logan raised his eyebrows. The spirits never answered promptly, if they bothered to answer at all.
"That was quick."
"I have been waiting."
"A long time, I reckon."
The spirit nodded.
"Well, we've come for—"
"For that thing that the sons of Eos entrusted to me. There must be desperate business in the world of men for you to seek it out."
Logan swallowed.
"When isn't there?"
"Do you see anything?"
Giselle whispered behind him.
"Nothing," replied Longfoot. "It is indeed a most remarkable—"
"Shut your mouths!"
snarled Baez over his shoulder. The spirit loomed down close over him.
"This is the first of the Magi?"
"It is," said Logan, keeping the talk to the point.
"He is shorter than Juven's. I do not like his look."
"What does it say?"
snapped Baez impatiently, staring into the air well to the left of the spirit. Logan scratched his face.
"It says that Juven's was tall."
"Tall? What of it? Get what we came for and let us be gone."
"He is impatient,"
rumbled the spirit.
"We've come a long way. He has Juven's staff."
The spirit nodded.
"The dead branch is familiar to me. I am glad. I have held this thing for long winters, and it has been a heavy weight to carry. Now I will sleep."
"Good idea. If you could—"
"I will give it to the woman."
The spirit dug its hand into its stony stomach, and Logan shuffled back warily. The fist emerged, and something was clutched inside, and he felt himself shiver as he saw it.
"Hold your hands out,"
he muttered to Pharaoh. Giselle gave an involuntary gasp and scrambled away as the thing dropped down into Pharaoh's waiting palms, raising an arm to shield his face, his mouth hanging open with horror. Baez stared, eyes wide. Kwai craned eagerly forward. Logan grimaced and rocked back. Longfoot scrambled almost all the way out of the hollow. For a long moment, all six of them stared at the dark object in Pharaoh's hands. No one moving, no one speaking, no sound except for the keening wind. There it was before them. That thing which they had come so far and braved so many dangers to find. That thing which Glistrod dug from the deep earth long years ago. That thing which had made a blasted ruin of the greatest city in the world. The seed. The other side made flesh. The very stuff of magic. Then Pharaoh slowly began to frown.
"This is it?"
she asked doubtfully.
"This is the thing that will turn Shaffa to dust?"
It did, in fact, now that Giselle was overcoming the shock of its sudden appearance, look like nothing more than a stone.
a chunk of unremarkable grey rock the size of a big fist. No sense of unearthly danger washed from it. No deadly power was evident. No withering rays or stabs of lightning shot forth. It did, in fact, look like nothing more than a stone. Baez blinked. He shuffled closer on his hands and knees. He peered down at the object in Pharaoh's palms. He licked his lips, lifting his hand ever so slowly, while Giselle watched, his heart pounding in his ears. Baez touched the rock with his little fingertip, then jerked it instantly back. He did not suddenly wither and expire. He probed it once more with his finger. There was no thunderous detonation. He pressed his palm upon it. He closed his thick fingers round it. He lifted it up. And still it looked like nothing more than a stone. The first of the Magi stared down at the thing in his hand, his eyes growing wider and wider.
"This is not it," he whispered, his lip trembling. "This is just a stone."
There was a stunned silence. Giselle stared at Logan, and the Northman gazed back, scarred face slack with confusion. Giselle stared at Longfoot, and the navigator could only shrug his bony shoulders. Giselle stared at Pharaoh, and he watched her frown grow harder and harder.
"Just a stone," she muttered.
"Not it," hissed Quai.
"Then..."
The meaning of Baez's words was only just starting to sink into Giselle's mind.
"I came all this way for nothing?"
A sudden gust blew up, snuffing out the miserable tongue of flame and blowing grit in his face.
"Perhaps there is some mistake," ventured Longfoot. "Perhaps there is another spirit. Perhaps there is another..."
"No mistake," said Logan, firmly shaking his head.
"But..."
Quai's eyes were bulging from his ashen face.
"But how?"
Baez ignored him, muscles working on the side of his head.
"Canidius. His hand is in this. He found some way to trick his brothers and switch this lump of nothing for the seed and keep it for himself. Even in death the Maker denies me."
"Just a stone?" growled Pharaoh.
"I gave up my chance to fight for my country," murmured Giselle, indignation starting to flicker up in his chest. "And I slogged hundreds of miles across the wasteland, and I was beaten and broken and left scarred for nothing?"
"The seed."
Quai's pale lips were curling back from his teeth, his breath snorting fast through his nose.
"Where is it? Where?"
"If I knew that," barked his master, "do you suppose we would be sitting here on this forsaken island, bantering with spirits for a chunk of worthless rock?"
And he lifted his arm and dashed the stone furiously onto the ground. It cracked open and split into fragments, and they bounced and tumbled and clattered down among 100 others, 1,000 others, 1,000,000 others the same.
"It's not here."
Logan shook his head sadly.
"Say one thing for..."
"Just a stone?"
snarled Pharaoh, her eyes swiveling from the fallen chunks of rock to Baez's face.
"You fucking old liar!"
She sprang up, fists clenched tight by her sides.
"You promised me vengeance!"
Baez rounded on her, his face twisted with rage.
"You think I have no greater worries than your vengeance?"
he roared, flecks of spit flying from his lips and out into the rushing gale.
"Or your disappointment?"
he screamed in Quai's face, veins bulging in his neck.
"Or your fucking looks?"
Giselle swallowed and faded back into the hollow, trying to seem as small as he possibly could, his own anger extinguished by Baez's towering rage as sharply as the meager fire had been by the blasting wind a moment before.
"Tricked!"
snarled the first of the Magi, his hands opening and closing with aimless fury.
"With what now will I fight Kalul?"
Giselle winced and cowered, sure at any moment that one of the party would be ripped apart, or be flung through the air and dashed on the rocks, or would burst into brilliant flames, quite possibly him. Brother Longfoot chose a poor moment to try and calm matters.
"We should not be downhearted, my comrades. The journey is its own reward."
"Say that once more, you shaven dolt," hissed Byers. "Only once more, and I'll make ashes of you."
The navigator shrank trembling away, and the Magus snatched up his staff and stalked off, down from the hollow towards the beach, his coat flailing around him in the bitter wind. So terrible had his fury been that, for a brief moment, the idea of staying on the island seemed preferable to getting back into a boat with him. It was with that ill-tempered outburst, Giselle supposed, that their quest was declared an utter failure.
"Well then," muttered Logan, after they had all sat in the wind for a while longer, "I reckon that's it."
He snapped the lid of the Maker's empty box shut.
"No point crying about it. You have to be—"
"Shut your fucking mouth, fool!" snarled Pharaoh at him. "Don't tell me what I have to be!"
And she strode out of the hollow and down towards the hissing sea. Logan winced as he pushed the box back into his pack, sighed as he swung it up onto his shoulder.
"Realistic," he muttered, then set off after her.
Longfoot and Quai came next, all sullen anger and silent disappointment. Giselle came up the rear, stepping from one jagged stone to another, eyes nearly shut against the wind, turning the whole business over in his mind. The mood might have been deathly somber, but as he picked his way back towards the boat, he found to his surprise that he was almost unable to keep the smile from his face. After all, success or failure in this mad venture had never really meant anything to him. All that mattered was that he was on his way home. The water slapped against the prow, throwing up cold white spray. The sailcloth bulged and snapped, the beams and the ropes creaked. The wind whipped at Pharaoh's face, but she narrowed her eyes and ignored it. Byers had gone below decks in a fury, and one by one the others had followed him out of the cold. Only she and Ninefingers stayed there, looking down at the sea.
"What will you do now?" he asked her.
"Go wherever I can kill the Gurkish,"
she snapped it without thinking.
"I will find other weapons and fight them wherever I can."
She hardly even knew if it was true. It was hard to feel the hatred as she had done. It no longer seemed so important a matter if the Gurkish were left to their business and she to hers, but her doubts and her disappointment only made her bark it the more fiercely.
"Nothing has changed. I still need vengeance."
Silence. She glanced sideways, and she saw Ninefingers frowning down at the pale foam on the dark water, as if her answer had not been the one he had been hoping for. It would have been easy to change it. "I'll go where you go," she could have said, and who would have been worse off? No one, certainly not her. But Pharaoh did not have it in her to put herself in his power like that. Now it came to the test, there was an invisible wall between them, one that there was no crossing. There always had been. All she could say was,
"You?"
He seemed to think about it a while, angry looking, chewing at his lip.
"I should go back to the north."
He said it unhappily without even looking at her.
"There's work there I should never have left. Dark work that needs doing. That's where I'll go, I reckon. Back to the north and settle me some scores."
She frowned. Scores? Who was it told her you had to have more than vengeance? Now scores was all he wanted? Lying bastard.
"Scores,"
she hissed.
"Good."
And the word was sour as sand on her tongue. He looked her in the eye for a long moment. He opened his mouth as if he was about to speak, and he stayed there, his lips formed into a word, one hand partway lifted towards her. Then he seemed suddenly to slump, and he set his jaw, and he turned his shoulder to her, and leaned back on the rail.
Good.
And that easily, it was all done between them. Pharaoh scowled as she turned away. She curled up her fists and felt her nails digging into her palms, furious hard. She cursed to herself and bitterly. Why could she not have said different words? Some breath and a shape of the mouth, and everything is changed. It would have been easy. Except that Pharaoh did not have it in her, and she knew she never would have. The Girkish had killed that part of her far away and long ago, and left her dead inside. She had been a fool to hope, and in her bones she had known it all along. Hope is for the weak. Chapter 50 Back to the Mud. Dogman and Dow, Tull and Grim, West and Pike. Six of them stood in a circle and looking down at two piles of cold earth. Below in the valley, the Union were busy burying their own dead. Dogman had seen it. Hundreds of them in pits for a dozen each. It was a bad day for men, all in all, and a good one for the ground. Always the way after a battle. Only the ground wins. Shivers and his carls were just through the trees, heads bowed, burying their own. 12 in the earth already, 3 more wounded, bad enough they'd most likely follow before the week was out, and another that had lost his hand, might live, might not, depending on his luck. Luck hadn't been good lately. Near half their number dead in one day's work. Brave of them to stick after that. Dogman could hear their words. Sad words and proud for the fallen. How they'd been good men, how they'd fought well, how bad they'd be missed and all the rest. Always the way after a battle. Words for the dead. Dogman swallowed and looked back to the fresh-turned dirt at his feet. Tough work digging, in the cold, ground frozen hard. Still, you're better off digging than getting buried, Logan would have said. And the dogman reckoned that was right enough. 2 people he'd just finished burying, and 2 parts of himself along with them. Cathill, deep down under the piled-up dirt, stretched out white and cold, and would never be warm again. 3 trees not far from her, his broken shield across his knees and his sword in his fist. 2 sets of hopes Dogman had put in the mud. Some hopes for the future, and some hopes from the past. All done now, and would never come to nothing, and they left an aching hole in him. Always the way after a battle. Hopes in the mud.
"Buried where they died," said Tull softly. "That's fitting. That's good."
"Good,"
barked Dow, glaring over at West.
"Good, is it? Safest place in the whole battle? Safest place, did you tell 'em?"
West swallowed and looked down, guilty-seeming.
"All right, Dow," said Tull. "You know better than to blame him for this, or anyone else. It's a battle. Folk die. 3 trees knew that well enough, none better."
"We could have been somewhere else," growled Dow.
"We could have been," said Dogman, "but we weren't. And there it is. No change in it, is there? 3 trees is dead, and the girl's dead, and that's hard enough for everyone. Don't need you adding to the burden."
Dow's fists bunched up, and he took a deep breath in like he was about to shout something. Then he let it out, and his shoulders sagged, and his head fell.
"You're right. Nothing to be done now."
Dogman reached out and touched Pike on his arm.
"Do you want to say something for her?"
The burned man looked at him, then shook his head. He wasn't much for speaking, the dogman reckoned, and he hardly blamed him. Didn't look like West was about to say nothing either.
So Dogman cleared his throat, wincing at the pain across his ribs, and tried it himself. Someone had to.
This girl we buried here, Cathal was her name. Can't say I knew her too long or nothing, but what I knew I liked, for what that's worth. Not much, I reckon. Not much. But she had some bones to her. I guess we all saw that on the way north. Took the cold and the hunger and the rest and never grumbled. Wish I'd known her better. Hope to, but, well, don't often get what you hope for. She weren't one of us, really. But she died with us, so I reckon we're proud to have her in the ground with ours.
Aye, said Dow. Proud to have her.
That's right, said Tull. Ground takes everyone the same.
Dogman nodded, took a long, ragged breath, and blew it out.
Anyone want to speak for Three Trees?
Dow flinched and looked down at his boots, shifting them in the dirt. Tull blinked up at the sky, looking like he had a bit of damp in his eye. Dogman himself was only a stride away from weeping as it was. If he had to speak another word, he knew he'd set to bawling like a child. Three Trees would have known what to say. But there was the trouble. He was gone. Seemed like no one had any words. Then Grimm took a step forward.
Rad Three Trees, he said, looking round at them one by one. Rock of Ufrith, they called him. No bigger name in all the north. Great fighter, great leader, great friend. Lifetime of battles. Stood face to face with a bloody nine. Then shoulder to shoulder with him. Never took an easy path if he thought it was the wrong one. Never stepped back from a fight if he thought it had to be done. I stood with him, walked with him, fought with him 10 years, all over the north.
His face broke out in a smile.
I've no complaints.
Good words, Grim, said Dow, looking down at the cold earth. Good words.
There'll be no more like Three Trees, muttered Tull, wiping his eye like he'd got something in it.
Aye, said the Dogman.
That was all he could manage. West turned and trudged off through the trees, his shoulders hunched up, not a word said. Dogman could see the muscles clenching in the side of his head, blaming himself, most likely. Men liked to do that a lot when folk died, in the Dogman's experience, and West seemed the type for it. Pike followed him, and the two of them passed Shivers coming up the other way. He stopped beside the graves, frowning down, hair hanging round his face, then he looked up at them.
Don't mean no disrespect, none at all, but we need a new chief.
The earth's only just turned on him, hissed Dow, giving him the eye.
Shivers held up his hands.
Best time to discuss it, then, I reckon, so there's no confusion. My boys are jumpy, being honest. They've lost friends, and they've lost Three Trees, and they need someone to look to, that's a fact. Who's it gonna be?
Dogman rubbed his face. He hadn't even thought about it yet, and now that he did, he didn't know what to think. Tal Duru Thunderhead and Black Dow were two big, hard names, both led men before and well. Dogman looked at them, standing there, frowning at each other.
I don't care which of you it is, he said. I'll follow either one. But it's clear as clear, it has to be one of you two.
Tull glared down at Dow, and Dow glowered back up at him.
I can't follow him, rumbled Tull. And he won't follow me.
That's a fact, hissed Dow. We talked it out already. Never work.
Tull shook his head.
That's why it can't be either one of us.
No, said Dow. It can't be one of us.
He sucked at his teeth, snorted some snot into his face, and spat it out onto the dirt.
That's why it has to be you, Dogman.
That's why what now?
Said Dogman, his eyes wide open and staring. Tull nodded.
You're the chief. We all agreed it.
Huh?
Said Grimm, not even looking up.
Nine fingers gone, said Dow,
and three trees gone, and that leaves you.
Dogman winced. He was waiting for Shivers to say, "You what? Him, Chief?" He was waiting for them all to start laughing and tell him it was a joke. Black Dow and Tulduru Thunderhead and Harding Grim, not to mention two dozen Carls besides, all taking his say-so? Stupidest idea he ever heard. But Shivers didn't laugh.
"That's a good choice, I reckon. Speaking for my lads, that's what I was going to suggest. I'll let 'em know."
And he turned and made off through the trees, with the Dogman gawping after him.
"But what about them others?"
he hissed once Shivers was well out of hearing, wincing at a stab of pain in his ribs.
"There's 20 fucking Carls down there, and Jumpy. They need a name to follow."
"You got the name," said Tull. "You came across the mountains with Nine Fingers, fought all those years with Bathod. There ain't no bigger names than yours left standing. You've seen more battles than any of us."
"Seen 'em, maybe."
"You're the one," said Dow, "and that's all. So you ain't the hardest killer since Scarlin, so what? Your hands are bloody enough for me to follow, and there's no better scout alive. You know how to lead. You've seen the best at it. Nine Fingers, and Bethod, and Three Trees. You've watched them all, close as can be."
"But I can't... I mean, I couldn't make no one charge, not the way Three Trees did."
"No one could," said Tull, nodding down at the earth. "But Three Trees ain't an option no more, sorry to say. You're the chief now, and we'll stand behind you. Any man don't care to do as you tell him can speak to us." "And that'll be one short-ass conversation," growled Dow. "You're the chief."
Tull turned and strode off through the trees.
"It's decided."
And Black Dow followed him.
"Eh?"
said Grim, shrugging his shoulders and making off with the other two.
"But," muttered the Dogman, "hold on!"
They'd gone. So he guessed that made him chief. He stood there for a moment, blinking, not knowing what to think. He was never leader before. He didn't feel no different. He didn't have any ideas all of a sudden, no notions of what to tell men to do. He felt like an idiot, even more of one than usual. He knelt down between the graves, and he stuck his hand in the soil, and he felt it cold and wet around his fingers.
"Sorry, girl," he muttered. "Didn't deserve this."
He gripped the ground tight, and he squeezed it in his palm.
"Very well, Three Trees. I'll try and do what you'd have done. Back to the mud, old man."
And he stood up, and he wiped his hand on his shirt, and he walked away, back to the living, and left the two of them behind him in the earth.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Before They Are Hanged, written by Joe Abercrombie, read by Stephen Pacey. Before They Are Hanged is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2007 by Joe Abercrombie. Audio production copyright 2010 by Orion Publishing Group Limited. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.